Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry and more. Now, today, I'm very lucky. I'm speaking with Māoriwa-born and Tamaki Makaurau-based broadcaster, MC, actress, and now communications powerhouse, Vishang Patawai. Graduating from Bay of Islands College in AUT, Vishang went behind the mic in the 1990s with MyFM, along the way picking up an award for Best New Broadcaster, actually two to be precise, and being the first Māori woman to do so. Vishang's over 30 years of experience has seen her become an important voice in empowering Māori, and in particular embracing culture and ancestry through her work as owner and operator of Relative Limited and Mad Ave Community Trust, among many other things. Welcome to the show, Vishang.
Kia ora, good morning. Thank you for having me, Jamie. It's awesome to be here.
What an impressive introduction I have in terms of there's so many things, so many facets to you, Vishang, and I think we're going to dip into a lot of that, and I'm looking forward to it. And a good place to start, and this is where I always like to start, Vishang, is what was life like growing up for you in Māoriwa, and how did those early experiences for you shape the woman you are today?
Yeah, kia ora. That's a really good question. I always love to start there too. So whakapapa is very important to me. So tuatahi ko wai tēnei, he uri tēnei no Ngāti Hine I te puake a hau ki Māoriwa. Ki te Taitokerau, he uri no ngā maramara o Hineamaru. So good morning. It's morning here wherever you are around the world, but it's an Aotearoa morning. I grew up in Māoriwa and I'm the youngest of six, and I have four brothers, so I grew up like a tomboy. And for anyone who knows Māoriwa, it is a small town in the North Island in Aotearoa. And it's more like I'm kind of related to everyone in the town, not like in a weird way, but it's just really small. It's really small. And, you know, I remember when I first moved from the north, from Taitokerau to Tamaki Makaurau here in Auckland, and started working at MyFM, they would always say to me, you can take the girl out of the bush, but you can never take the bush out of the girl. And I think that's actually, for me, it's really, really true. Those formative years, you know, have absolutely everything to do in terms of the work that I do, in terms of the people that I work with, in terms of the values that I have. And yeah, it's just really, really important. So as I said, from a small town, I grew up with my nanny. I'm named after my grandmother. And I think there's something really unique about children who are raised with their grandparents. There's just like a, in te ao Māori, we call it like tau. Like there's this way of being when you're raised around old people where you just kind of move at a slower pace. And, you know, so I'm really grateful to be raised by my grandma. Both my parents worked at AFCO. So for those of you who don't know what that is, that's the freezing works. In Māoriwa, that was the number one employer throughout the north, actually. Most people travel to Māoriwa to work. So it was a thriving, bustling metropolis then when I was growing up, because that's where the freezing works was. Have a very strong sense of social justice. Growing up in a town like Māoriwa, it tends to have a very, what's the word, Jamie? Like a very people from the outside look at it and it looks very broken and disparate because of the high unemployment rates, because of high rates around crime and that sort of thing. But if you're raised in those environments, you know that they're a rich repository of innovation, of beauty, of excellence that you don't really understand unless you're raised inside those environments. So it's absolutely shaped who I am and, you know, my expression of those things in the world.
And it's a reflection of small town New Zealand in general, where a lot of those towns did rely on certain industries. So when those industries close, for example, AFCO, it does take a massive hit to the economy. And like you said, it does have like a shake-on effect, but that does also bring sort of that Kiwi spirit where people get together, and Māori spirit as well, where people are very ingenious in terms of thinking of new ideas and new ways to work around that. And one thing I was curious to ask you, what was your weapon of choice when it came to eeling? I very much grew up with the same sort of like vibe growing up as a kid. We spare a net that I used to take down to the local river near me. What was your weapon of choice there, Vishang?
Yeah, very cool question. So the name of my town that I grew up in is actually Tunatown. For those of you who don't know, its nickname is Tunatown. So it's Māoriwa, that's what it's normally called, or it's Motown, or it's Tunatown if you grew up there. So the Tuna it's very significant to us at home. I don't actually like eating tuna. Hopefully, I hear this, Jamie, and be like, "What are you talking about?" But my cousins are very skillful, so their hinaki that they use are like Māori traditional traps and that sort of thing, and they're very skillful. Like they can catch them with their hands. I am not going to lie and say that I am a PhD eel catcher, but very, very proud to come from Tuna Town.
And you talked about growing around your nanny. You've always been surrounded by a pretty strong woman. How did that kind of matriarchal influence affect you, like, during growing up and later in life? Because, yeah, for anyone who doesn't realize, that the matriarchal, like, power in Māori in particular is very strong. It's, like, a very big part of their identity. How did that affect you in terms of growing up? Was it something that you kind of look back on now and you're like, that did have a pretty big influence in how you kind of are as a parent yourself as well? And also how you went through life.
Yeah, so my tribe from the north is Ngāti Hine, and Hine means woman. And my tribe is named after our eponymous ancestress, Hineamaru. And Hineamaru is a famed ariki. And within Te Ao Māori, even though women wahine are very prolific in terms of our leadership, you know, a lot of our tribes are named after men, but my tribe is actually named after a woman, which is gangster cool. And so she was known for her ability to, she was like an adventurer. So she navigated the lands. And up north, there's a boundary called Te Rohe Pōtai o Hineamaru, which is the boundaries that she walked with her family that then became her ancestral lands. And why she's famous is because she established gardens. And she found fertile soil, and her thing was like, if I can find soil and we can plant seeds, we will feed generations to come. So she was very visionary in terms of the way she saw the world, her responsibility in terms of her whānau, her hapū, and her iwi. And so I'm really proud about that, to, you know, be an uri, a descendant of Hineamaru. You're right, I grew up around my nanny, I grew up around my mum, and there's a very strong leadership line that's matriarchal within our tribe. The women in my tribe tend to be very opinionated, very lippy, and very sassy, Jamie. They're like, they're pretty to look at, but you got to be someone special to marry one. I'll tell you, you don't want to get my husband up in there. But it's absolutely shaped, you know, all the work that I do around empowering women. And we're doing a whole lot of work at the moment in New Zealand because our government have just repealed the equity pay claim for women, which dramatically impacts wahine Māori, wahine Pasifika, and women in the disabled and migrant community. So, you know, we are very staunch when it comes to women, and also men. Like, even though I'm you know, 100% pro Māori and pro wahine Māori, is in Te Ao Māori, what's as important is a reciprocal leadership. So it's a little bit different from a feminist model in the Western culture, right? Is women are as important as men and men are as important as women. And if we get that right, then we have reciprocal symbiotic leadership. So.
And I love this balance, and I feel like the strong will is something that was always within you, even at the young age, from the fact that you said, yeah, you're a bit of a tomboy growing up, and also the fact that I've heard in another interview that you talked about the fact that you ended up leaving school at quite a young age. Was that a little bit of a part of that as well, that strong opinion, you had your way about you, and you're like, you know what, like, I know this isn't the path for me. It's not always going to be a straight line. I have my own way of, like, going about it. Like, looking back now, do you kind of feel like it was always this to happen, that you were going to find your own path?
What an interesting question. I remember singing in the mirror from the age of 6 with a hairbrush and going, I don't know why they keep hiring those people on What Now? That should be me. I must be there. Right. And so I always knew that I wanted to work in broadcasting. I always actually wanted to work in television or film growing up. I idolized Madonna. And, like, it would crack up. My whole room was, like, wall-to-wall posters of Madonna. You know, and it's so funny, Jamie. Like, I used
Hell
to dress
yeah.
like Madonna. And, you know, you want to see, like, Moira, there's only, like, 2,000 people. And then I've got, like, the cut-off gloves and the pearls and the ribbons and all the things, right? I think my parents and my whānau did a really good job at nurturing my creativity, and I didn't do very well in school. And I often talk about that, and I wish, like, you know, with my children, I often say, you know, so I was very good at sport, but and very good in the creative kind of area, but I was not good at sport. But if, I'm sorry, I was not good at academics. But if someone had said they're actually the same discipline, Vishane. So how you train for hours after school every day on your own at the padded tennis court or the basketball court or whatever sport you're playing, volleyball court, if you just take that focus and you put it here into academia, it's the same thing, you'll thrive. But that bridge was not there, and we didn't have mentors at the time. Both my parents worked. They gave me great models of leadership and work ethic and that sort of thing. But there was a missing with either a teacher or someone saying, it's actually really simple, and if you apply yourself to academics the way that you do to sport, you'll fly. So I think for a lot of our kids, that's the same. Like we tend to thrive in kapa haka or singing or creative things or you know, or sport, but unless that is then channeled in the right way, you can have a listening of yourself like I did, which was, I'm dumb, I don't know school, but I am really good at sport. So a little bit, like I always knew I'd end up in broadcasting, but I didn't quite know the path, but I knew that it would happen.
Are you feeling like there's a bit of a change now, especially in terms of education? Because I can speak to my own and say that while I didn't get kicked out of school, I certainly had the same experience where I just felt like, admittedly, a bit of a dumbass at school. And then I look back now to kids that are growing up, and I feel like there's definitely a lot more mentorship or a lot more emphasis that's put on to trying to find different methods to get kids to that same level or to achieve in a certain way, much more than probably like during my time. And that was only like, geez, how long ago would it be now? Like 20 years ago that I was like still at school. So yeah, do you find that it's kind of building up to that point now where we are seeing a little bit more of that coming through?
Yeah, I think our generation, so our generation went through that. And then so like with my kids, we were like, okay, we're going to start a kombucha business for you guys at 8, right? So from our generation now, there's that. And then there's also like, well, mum owns my own business. And what business are you going to own? What, you know, my son's 14. And so we want you to start learning how to invest in shares. So my parents never talked to me about that. They talked to me about AFCO, and yeah. I saw the work ethic, right? I got it, which is deeply ingrained in who I am and how I am in the world around my work. But I think, and then also we had this explosion of technology and a podcast and Mr. Beast, and, you know, we never had that, but our kids are like, why can't I be Mr. Beast? Why can't I write my own code to start my own game? And who says I can't be an entrepreneur at 16? And so I believe that when we can see it, we can be it. And so now there's this whole industry that didn't exist when we were growing up that's, you know, with AI and everything else, that's rapidly evolving where our kids can find their gift and their talent, and it's much more easily accessible, especially with the democratization of media.
100%. And there was an interesting mentor that you had growing up as well, which is Marianne Baker, who played a pretty pivotal role in terms of getting you to where you changed like your attitude a little bit of how like you carried yourself in the professional manner, which, to be fair, I've had the exact same sort of experience as well, where I had a mentor that's like, yeah, you can still dress like a 17-year-old skater kid, but you kind of need to be able to put the shirt on occasionally. How pivotal was it having that kind of like background with Marianne Baker kind of being like, come on, Vishane, like, I know you have this whole thing of like learning by doing, but sometimes we do have to put the nice shirt on and see what happens. Was that quite like a cool wee experience to have with her?
Yeah, I'm really blessed in that I've had very powerful female role models. And Marianne came into my life at a really pivotal time. I'd just, you know, been kicked out of school at the time. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And she gave me an opportunity to join this course in Moirua for Māori girls, right? It is in our smaller towns, even though they're full of innovation, they're not like Auckland. There's not as many educational opportunities, vocational opportunities, training opportunities, work opportunities, right? And so at the time that was really innovative. And so she came into my life, I did the course, I loved it, I graduated, she said teach it, so I taught the next one. And it was really, you know, when I did that, it was the first time that I ever stayed in a hotel. I mean, I was like 17 18, I'd never stayed in a hotel in my life. I had never, she sent us to like all these makeup courses at Cut Above and Shiseido and Revlon, and it really just opened my eyes to the world. And it was pivotal, but I really have had the most incredible, you know, Vivian Bridgewater was another incredible mentor, which I'm sure we'll talk about in terms of broadcasting, who I'm involved with to this day, actually, where I've seen the women and I've gone, wow, okay, that's cool. And really through osmosis have learnt the codes for success.
And the way that you entered into the broadcasting industry itself is kind of a testament, once again, to the strong will. And I love the story of the fact that you pretended to be part of a broadcasting course in order to get through the door. Can you walk me through how you were going to kind of get out of that situation if someone properly called you out on it? Because it sounds like you kind of just managed to, like, slip in, sit in the back and be like, yeah, I'm a part of this. Like, no one's going to question it. Like, what was going through your mind at the time? Was it kind of just like, I have to do this now, or like, I'm never going to do it?
I was young at the time and I was working in retail, and, you know, someone had said they're having these interviews at MyFM, and MyFM was very new. It was so new at the time. And I was like, what the heck is MyFM? And they were like, well, it's this new Māori owned radio station. I was like, ooh, well, I'm Māori. That might count for something. And so they said, look, they're holding interviews, but they're holding it with this, like, broadcasting course of young people who are doing some course of some kind. I don't even know if it was broadcasting. It was probably plumbing or building, for goodness sake. Right. And then I happened to find out about it. They were like, just show up and pretend you're part of the group. And I was like, what? I can't do that. They're going to not, what? Anyway, I show up at MyFM at the time, and it was at this place in Crummer Road in Ponsonby at the time I walk up the steps, and there's this group of young rangatahi standing in there, right? And I walk through the door. Just as I'm walking through the door, Tauta Iruwera, who was the station manager at the time, is walking down to greet them, and I just jump into the back of the group. Anyway, they turn around and they're like, who is this random chick that's jumping into the group? I jump into the group, and then by osmosis get into the interview, have the interview, end up getting the job there, you know. And I was really lucky. I actually got the job as Vivian Bridgewater's PA when I started there, right? And to answer your question, what would I have said? You know, I think I may have actually outed myself.
That's even more bold. Love it.
Yeah, like, you know, like, yeah.
Catching them on the back foot, being like, what are you going to do now?
Yeah, just jumped in here. And you know, like, what I say to my daughters, my daughter's 18 at the moment and has just finished school, right? And I said to her, you know, when I joined MyFM, like, I worked for about 6 months with no pay, you know, because she's like, I just want to walk into, like, Culture Kings and get a job and, like, Foot Locker. And I'm like, no, honey, it doesn't work like that. Like, you know, if you put yourself out there and you show that you're a hard worker and that you're thirsty and hungry for it and committed, then doors will open, but we have to do our part. So I got in and I got hired as Vivian's PA in marketing and marketing comms and branding.
Because you weren't originally wanting to be a host, were you? That kind of just fell into the kind of fell into your lap, like, eventually, because you were only 19 at the time when you got that role. You'd been in Auckland 6 months, which is crazy, the turnaround you had, like, the way that you just put yourself out there, got yourself in there, and yet you went straight to on air. Like, how did that situation even occur? Like, how did it go from you working in promos and marketing to then going straight on air? That must have been crazy. Was it people hearing your chat and being like, but Shane's really got a way about her, we need to throw on air, she's crack up? Or was it kind of more or less like something that was like, the person that was meant to do the night shift didn't turn up, but Shane, you're up, like, throwing you into the lion's den? What was the situation that occurred?
Yeah, I think it was probably a mix of those things. So, one, I worked closely with Vivian, and so I knew all the on-air crew really, really well because I was either working with them out at schools, doing promo, you know, really building this brand from scratch, and all we really had was people. And this bold, hairy, audacious goal to make speaking Māori cool, cool to kōrero, right? That was one of the first catchphrases. And how it was, actually, I was in marketing and comms for actually longer than 6 months. So I was in marketing. I worked with Vivian for probably about, I want to say a year to 18 months. And then I was out doing promo all the time. And during that time, I just like a sponge with Vivian, right? And she was, bro, I'm telling you, she was savage. Like, she would throw me in the lion's den. She was like, you need to go through this, the yellow pages or the white pages back in the day, right? And you need to ring all these people. I was like, I don't know how to ring. I don't know how to get clients on board to give me free things. And they're like, no, that's your job. I'd never done it, right? I'm from Wairoa. I'm like, what the heck? So I'm like literally cold calling Adidas, Hoyts, Nike, like all of these massive agency clients, talking them into MyFM, who they'd never heard of, right? And getting them on board, like the zoo and all these big places to get giveaways so that we could start to generate, kind of traction and contra and giveaways on air. So I became very, very skilled very quickly at understanding from a broadcasting point of view, but also from a COPPA point of view, how you balance cultural integrity with commercial imperatives. How do you do that? And what is the line? And how do you have integrity with that? So, you know, I'm always so grateful for that, because that is that's the absolute whakapapa of me having a communications engagement and social impact agency, is really everything that I learned in those first few years from Vivian and Toda and Ross and Dave Bridgman. And then what actually happened was they had to cut back stuff, and they let a whole lot of staff go. And they were like, we love you, but we can't afford to keep you here. You're going to have to go on reception. And I was like, okay, sweet. Yeah, no, all good. So then they moved me into reception, and then I was answering the phones, right? I'm answering the phones. And I think Ross, who was then the program director, Ross Goodwin, right? He's like a legend in broadcasting. He was one of the people who started Radio Hauraki in the Gulf when they were pirates. So he's this god in radio. And kia ora, MyFM, can I help you? Like, and then he was like, your voice ain't that bad. I mean, it's not great, but it ain't that bad. And literally, there was a number of things that caused that created this perfect storm. So Donna Pivac was the nighttime hostess. And she's this, look, drop dead, gorgeous, marketer's dream. Like, she's this green-eyed, curly-haired, beautiful Māori woman that all you need to do is post a picture of her and then your ratings are going to go through the roof because she's freaking beautiful. The other thing about Donna is she had the most sexiest voice, right? And the best thing about Donna is she was one of those people who doesn't know she's beautiful, right? Which makes her even more endearing. So she was just like the whole thing. Of course, right? She was like the entire whole package. And then she actually got tired of it and was like, yeah, I don't really want to do it. And then they were stuffed because there was only one nighttime jock. Well, there was only one female jock announcer at the time. And then Ross was kind of like, well, you're female. And I was like, great. And then, I'm underplaying it, but he was like, look.
Yeah, come on, for Shane. No, there was something there. It kind of just been the fact that you're a woman. Come on.
Well, he was like, look, you've got a really great personality. People love you, right? And we can work on the voice. And I was like, okay. And he was like, so do you want to go on air? And I was like, no, I don't want to go on air. Like, those ones who are on air, they're just all full of it, and they just think they're all that. And I'm this girl from the sticks who keeps it real. And then they were like, no, we think you've got a real shot. And so I was like, okay, yeah, look, I'll give it a shot. So then they trialed us on breakfast, and then they said, yep, you've got the gig. And then I did the dawn show for like 6 months Jamie, I didn't speak for like 3 months. I was so scared, even though it was me and the cleaners, because it's midnight to 6 a.m., and the truck drivers and the pie deliverers who were listening. I was so terrified, and I was so whakama and shy and scared. That I just didn't speak for ages, and then eventually I started speaking, and I did that for about 6 months. And at the same time, that was kind of where they were training me. And then Donna eventually left, and they were like, look, you're in here. So then I did the night show for a number of years. And I remember I had just started broadcasting, and I went to Ross, and I said, the radio awards were this big deal, right? Everyone, it's like the Oscars for Aotearoa in broadcasting. And I went to him and I said, I want to win the Best New Broadcaster Award. And he was like, well, that's great, but no woman's won it. And I was like, okay, great. And he was like, and no Māori woman's won it. And I was like, okay, and? And he was like, okay.
I love that.
Yeah. And I was like, and? And he was like, okay, great. If you're serious about it, this is what we need to do. this is what you need to prepare. You need to prepare a reel. And I prepared it. And then that year, I ended up winning Best New Broadcaster in the country. And I remember we were in Wellington at the Big Bougie Awards. And Vivian pulled me aside and gave me a hug. And she said, you have no idea what this means. Like, you're young and at the beginning of your career, but you have no idea what this means for Māori, what it means for my FM, what it means for the kaupapa. But now I do.
And I'm glad, because I think radio has always been quite impactful in New Zealand. Like, I think when I'm trying to explain to people how important radio is in New Zealand, even now, it kind of blows their mind. Even here in Argentina, where radio is still quite like a big medium, if you go to the UK, US, anywhere else, like, most people kind of know the odd radio host, but in New Zealand, it's like a crucial thing. It's like that whole friend that you know kind of thing. Like, my mum talks about radio hosts like they are her friends. She'd be like, you never believe what Christopher said the other day. And I'm like, who's Christopher? And it's like the host for My FM or More FM or whoever. And yeah, she'll directly be talking about it. And I think that you're bang on. The importance of what you did and that award that you won would have resonated for a lot of people. And is it only now that you kind of feel like you realize how big of a deal it was? Or did it kind of hit you at the time as well?
I got a sense of it at my, we always knew we were doing something vitally, critically important. You know what I mean? Like, we always knew that it was much bigger than us. And because, Jane, you got to remember, like, when my FM started, we were just a joke. People in the industry were like, you should just go set up in a little caravan at an Otara at the Saturday markets, and you should just do your little thing there. My FM, like, there was nothing on the scene at the time. There was no hip-hop, there was no R&B being played. Maybe the occasional number one from Casey Kasem in the States had made it through, and then, you know, the big radio stations were playing it. So there was nothing like that. And so, you know, it was, we knew it was special, but we really didn't understand the gravity of it at the time. And there was so much blatant racism where people were just like, oh, how cute. How cute that you're giving it a go, you know, like, good on you. And that made us just even more determined. And I don't think people really understood the caliber of people or leadership that Toda and Vivian had seconded into my FM. So you had Toda, whose background is, you know, decades of being part of Ngā Tamatoa and staunch grassroots, Ngāti Whātua, hyper-connected. Then you had Vivian, who was married to Blackie, the number one radio jock in the country, that was idolized and worshipped, who knew radio like no one else, right? Because she was in it. Who could sell ice to an Eskimo, and who knew every agency, and she could charm it was just charming. And then you had Dave Bridgman, who had worked in radio for years and was our technical engineer, sound. And you had Ross Goodwin, who was this god in radio. So people looked at it and they were like, oh, how cute. But they did not realize, like, the level of expertise that was inside of it, driving it. And then behind the scenes, you had, like, Pat Sneddon, and you had, like, Hahi Walker, and you had Pākehā allies that were like, this is so important and we are going to back it in all levels, you know. So, but it was really tough. Like, people, yeah, they just laughed and said, good on you for going to your little school promos with no money. Because we didn't. We had no money. We had no money. It was the most audacious, unbelievable thing you could try, because, you know, we were the one of the only independents against, like, these multi-million dollar communication conglomerates, media conglomerates. And then you had this startup little Māori radio station that was only could go to 88.6, which meant it wasn't even properly on the band, and only Japanese import cars could listen to us, which actually turned out to be hugely beneficial in the end. But yeah, people, and then, so there was that part, but then people wouldn't advertise with My FM. So even though we were rating, people were like, the only people who listen to My FM are shoplifters. And no, thank you, we don't want to advertise with you. So it was all of this stuff that was happening in the background. But then you had these, see, Vivian was brilliant in that she said, let's get beautiful, cute relevant role models like Robert Rakete. Let's get him off primetime television where he's the number one most highly recognized talent, right, from RTR Countdown, and let's bring him over and all of that audience. Like, just the most brilliant marketing and strategy around it that had it be successful. But if you look at it, we had no big backers. Fatua were not that rich at that point to be able to, you know, financially invest in it. So, you know, just it's a kind of really David and Goliath story, and just the most incredible and amazing thing to grow up in. I grew up there. So I started there when I was 19 and I finished when I was like 31 or 32. So grew up there.
That is always the incredible story I found with Maya, because when you look at it now, it is a powerhouse. It's probably one of the highest rated stations in the MediaWorks catalogue. And then on top of that, something I'd be interested to know is, did you feel like the audience from the very beginning was backing you, or did you feel like it was kind of you had to prove yourself to the audience as well? The assumption will always be people will think, oh, only Maori listeners are the ones that will be listening to Maya. But was it kind of like you realized how much of a gap it was bridging as well for other people that maybe initially wanted to be a bit more of a part of the community as well, including Pākehā?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So for Māori, it was a given. We were hungry for it. You know, our slogan was Call to Kōrero. And when we first started going into schools, Jamie, which was like our MO, that was like what we had people power, and we had cool people power. And if you look at that nowadays, that translates into currency on social media. It would just like be ridiculous, right? The influencers that they grew back then were phenomenal. But, you know, when we went into schools and we said, okay, all the Māori kids, raise your hand. Kids didn't raise their hand. Like, they were not proud to be Māori. They were still whakamā to be Māori. And it was cool to be PI, and it was cool to be, you know, Pacifica, but it wasn't cool to be Māori at the time. And so our job was to have kids be proud to be Māori, you know, and doing that through our language, doing that through beautiful hip-hop at the time. And so for Māori, there was, I wouldn't say a hunger like there is today, because we're now three decades on, almost three and a half decades on, right? So generations have now been raised in kura. So these kids, there's no identity issues, right? But when we first started, for Māori, it was even then a little bit tough, because we had to convince ourselves that we were proud to be Māori, you know, whereas now that doesn't exist. And so there was a hunger there for Māori, and then there was a hunger for the underdog. So, you know, this kind of social justice. we got lots of support from people that were like, this isn't an amazing kaupapa. This is about pride. This is about Māori ownership. This is about making a mark in an industry where Māori have never had their own voice and ownership. So it did, you know, like all of the really trendy Ponsonby people were listening to Māori, because it was still quite underground. It wasn't kind of mainstream at that point. It was kind of like, what's that other one that was kind of like us? I can't think of it right now, but a little bit underground, you know? So you
kind of. Not like Channel Z or something like that.
Not like Channel Z, like kind of early adopters. Like, we listen to Mai and we're into like black music and hip hop. And, you know, it was kind of like that. And then eventually it just became mass, en masse, which it is today. And we actually, you know, and the other thing I want to say is when I first started, there were no women on air. There were very, very few radio announcers that were women. Very, very few. So I was doing the night show, but there was Love Hits or Love Songs Till Midnight with, I can't even remember his name, but he was like, I loved him. Everyone in Auckland loved him. And, you know, Vivian would say, oh, you're never going to rate against him. Like, he's been doing it for 50 years and it was Love Songs Till Midnight and everyone listened to it. And then, you know, like a year after, we were rating number one at night, which was this huge, amazing, incredible thing.
I have to ask, Love Songs, was he a silky, smooth, older fella, was he?
The older guy, you know the one? Like, he was
around
here and he did Love Songs Till Midnight and he had a voice like that and everyone listened to him. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, I'm going to have three people listening to me. But within, I think, probably within a year, we were consistently rating number one at night. And so the audience grew really quickly and it was a very loyal audience.
Do you remember the first caller you had through? Because callers are always a big part of those types of live music sort of shows. Do you remember the first caller you got through? And was it quite a memorable conversation for you?
I think it was my auntie, eh?
No way, yeah?
I think it was my auntie, because I was like, you know, no one was listening to me and my auntie rang at like 3 a.m. going, oh, I'm just ringing to do a shout-out, bub. I'm just just ringing to do a little curation, bub. Just letting you know auntie's working and we got you blasting here at the factory. And, yeah, so, you know, kind of that first 6 months where I was just, you know, on the dawn, you know, presenting early in the morning was great because I could just play and, you know, it wasn't that hard. So I think it was actually my auntie, Jamie. Shout out to my auntie wherever you are now.
Bless. And I think another thing that probably played into how your success came about was probably the realness, like how real you are with me now and how open you are about everything. Do you feel that played a part as well in your success as a host and maybe changing the personality of the host as instead of being this untouchable sort of god that has a silky smooth voice all the time and is having everyone swoon? Was it kind of like you just played yourself? You weren't trying to play a character. You were just the Shane. Do you think that played a part in why you're rating so well?
Yeah, I think that definitely, I mean, you know, hey, they didn't hire me for my voice. I remember Ross Goodwin saying to me, we can work on the voice. you know, but he did say to me, you've got a great personality and people love you. And that's what we want to have come through. I don't care what you sound like. If we can get that to translate, then, you know, people will love you and, or, you know, people will, you're relatable, you're real. And you're right, Jamie, like it's always been, you know, I've never really had an on-air persona. It was really funny. I got to tell you, this is crack up, right? So we have adult kids. Like I had my son when I was at my FM. I got pregnant with my son, who's now 29 this year. And, you know, and then we have three other children who are teenagers, 18, 16, and 15. And their parents, like my daughter said to me yesterday, actually, oh my gosh, Mum, I met this woman. And she was like, excuse me, are you V-Shane's daughter? And the Hannah, who is our daughter, was like, oh, yeah, that's my mum. And she was like, oh my gosh, like I used to listen to her all the time, Hannah. Can I get a photo? You know, like just crack. And my kids are like, what? Not so much our eldest son, Hohaya, because he grew up in it. Like he would come to promos with us and he knew all the announcers. But my other three children, they're just like, they are bewildered. They are bewildered, right? And they are like, you know, Mum, if this was nowadays, you would be like a $1 trillion influencer like Mr. Beast, because people, do you know my friend's mum? She said to me the other day that your mum was the most famous female DJ in the whole of the country. And do you know what I did, Mum? I cracked up. So my kids, they're just like, oh my gosh. Because people, you know, like you said, like people just the other day, they're like, wait, because my name's so weird, right? Like it's, you know, like they go, V-Shane, wait, my fam? And I'm like, yes. And they're like, wow, I just listened to you growing up and thank you. And, you know, so it's really funny. Even now, it happens all the time because my name is so different. And then people go, wait a minute. Or they either say that or they say, I always thought that was like a tag, like a bombing tag that you made up, like Madonna. No, that's actually my name.
I love how you're having the mix of like, yeah, your kids now hearing from parents saying like, oh, for Shane was cool as, like, this is awesome. Like, it must be a bit of a... It just must be a weird situation.
It's a little bit awkward. Yeah. They're like, Mum, that's just awkward. Like, awkward.
Is it the whole thing of the like, oh, lame, Mum used to be popular. Like, damn, like she's ruining it for us. I'm losing my cred like in the schoolyard because Mum's more popular than I am.
I think it's a little bit of all the things. Part of it is that they just don't believe it. They're just like, wait, they had radio when you were young? I was like, oh my gosh.
And I'll shift to the kind of narrative of where we're going now, because I think Mai was such a big part of your life, but you've moved into other areas and, you know, kind of in the name of the Beyond Broadcast, because you've done stuff beyond broadcasting. You did acting as well. I don't want to touch on it too much, but how was it pivoting into acting as well? Because that's a completely different kettle of fish, you appearing in front of the camera. How did you find that?
You know how that came about was when I won Best New Broadcaster, Robert, said to me, you should get you an agent. And I was like, why? What's an agent? What for? He said, we had really good relationships at MyFM and everything was really open and transparent and honest. And he was like, no, you should be doing lots of other things. And he introduced me to his agent at the time, and I signed up. And then she was started sending me to acting and auditions. And I was like, I'm not an actor. Like, I haven't done that. and she was like, that's okay. That's all right. Well, let's just send you. And then so they sent me, and then I did the auditions a little bit like my FM, and then I got the parts, and then I started doing films and acting, and that's where I met my husband, and I started doing presenting roles. And presenting has always been easy because it's a very similar broadcasters, whether it's here on a podcast or whether it's on radio or whether it's, you know, on stage. If you're a speaker, you've already developed that skill set. So, you know, for me, I can turn on the camera and I whack out a 30-second TikTok. It's like, there's nothing. It's just like breathing to me. It's been that long since I've done it. And so acting was a little bit different because I was like, this is a bit weird. But, you know, Jamie, like what I've always said to myself is just say yes. Be Shane, for every opportunity that comes to you, just say yes and figure it out. And, you know, and there are times where I'm terrified. Like when I eventually agreed to go on air, I was terrified and I was still a yes. So I really teach the young people that I work with and, you know, my own children, just be a yes, be a yes. You know, if it's meant for you, it's come. Or if it's meant for you, it will happen. So same thing with broadcasting as a DJ, same thing with acting, same thing with presenting, same thing with starting my own business, is every opportunity that's come my way, even if it's a stretch or I have no clue how I'm going to fulfill it, I'm always a yes to it.
And where did that first off feeling of fear come from? What was the thing that you feared when it came to going on air?
I think I actually grew up really shy, and people laugh at that because, you know, now I'm a public speaker, and I learned to be a public speaker at MyFM. One of my first promotional gigs on stage was at the Pacifica Festival, and there were 20,000 people in front of my stage. And they were like, you'll be fine, just get out there. And I was like, wow, I'm so, like, so scared and gripping the mic and stuttering and the whole bit. But doing that has then taught me, oh, actually, no, it wasn't that bad. Sorry, tell me your question again, Jamie. What was it?
It was, where did that fear initially come from? So you mentioned shyness, but was there any other feelings or thoughts going through your mind about, like, I'm not sure I can do this. Why am I doing this? Why am I putting myself in this situation? Was there anything else behind that?
Yeah. I think, so as I said, I grew up shy. And I think, you know, if we're really honest, there's always the fear of failure. Like, what if I open my mouth and I'm, like, dumb? Or what if people don't like me, or what if they think I'm weird, or what if I get criticized? So, you know, that's always present for me. And I remember Vivian gave me the book to read, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And I love that book and I live my life by it. The fear will never subside. It will never go away. And what I've trained and developed myself to do is go, okay, thank you. Next. Thank you. Next. Thank you. Next. Ariana Grande. Thank you. Next. It's present and it's there, but that will never stop me from taking the action that I know will yield the result. But I've learned that. I've learned that, and I've trained myself and developed myself to be very effective with that.
And is that also playing into a bit of mana as well, and being like, I have this, like, this spirit, this power behind me that I know I can do this, like that self-belief? Do you think that also became a part of it as well, and when you started getting a little bit more confidence?
Yeah, I think that's always been there. Like, I was very blessed in those early years to grow up in a very stable, loving whānau. And I think if a child grows up in that environment, that no matter where they go, they will find their feet. So that's always been there, but I was shy. I was chronically shy. Like, I used to hide behind my mum's skirt and kind of peep around the corner. So that was something that I learned, and I've always known my innate value. And I get that from my grandmother and my mother and the role models around me, yeah.
And now you've become a role model yourself, Shane, because you're working to empower Māori, especially Māori women, through your businesses. And how does that feel? Because it must be a bit of a responsibility in its own sense. Do you feel at times, because you once said, if you can't lead, you can't lead if you can't lead yourself, Do you feel like that was kind of like something you worked on while also becoming that same leader for other people?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like, in Te Ao Māori, like, you know, the word tino rangatiratanga, which is often connected to leadership, autonomy, independence, and all of those values. What that actually means is someone who has the ability to ranga the tira. Ranga means to weave together, and tira is people. So when we talk about leadership from a cultural perspective, it's leadership that brings people together and recognizes their gifts and empowers them, as opposed to, oh, I'm the leader, let me tell you how it should go. No, what we all have gifts, and often the barrier to having those gifts be actualized and realized is that the people working with the people who are not normally seen as leaders, they just don't have the ability or the language to ask questions that unlocks what's already there. So for me, it's always servant leadership is the model that we have. Like, it's a privilege to serve. I don't really see myself as a leader. So where I'm from in the north, we have a whakatauki that says, kāre te kumara e kōrero ana ki tōna ake reka, which means the kumara never speaks of its own sweetness. That's one of our most revered whakatauki. And then we have another one that says, ngā tihine whakaiti, 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 which means always be humble, always be humble, always be humble. So for me, around leadership, there's always, I just see it as being of service and making a contribution and empowering others such that their leadership is realised.
And what do you feel has been some of the biggest success stories you've seen in a lot of the programs and courses that you run as a part of this? Because I'm sure that there is many women that you could probably speak to great lengths of, but is there any particular success story that you've seen through some of the programs that you've run that you've like look back now and you're like, man, like, look at how far she's come, or look how far they've come as a leader? And I'm guessing a lot of them are probably working with you now, if I'm probably making an assumption.
Yeah, very cool. So one story that I can share, and is one of many, is Tui Hawk, Tui o Takaparawhau Hawk, joined Urutapu, which was one of our flagship Kohine leadership programs, developing young Māori women's leadership. And that was funded by Foundation North and was part of the Māori Pacific Education Initiative. And it's an award-winning program, so we won, you know, I think we won two parliamentary awards for outstanding community-led leadership and youth leadership. And so Tui joined when she was 16 from Alfriston College, and she stayed in that program and graduated that program. When she was 18, 19, she came to work for us. She then spent 2 years overseas serving a mission in the Philippines and came back, and then she grew our mana wahine community from, I think I was, we had like 500 people. It was fairly abysmal, but then Tui came on board and she grew it to what it is now, 22,500 wahine. And that for me is an expression of success, because she came through the entire pipeline. So, and she often helps us. So she is currently helping me at the moment run a series of online research projects to find out what women think around housing, what they think around enterprise, business, and she is helping co-design them. She facilitates for us to this day. She's in her final year at university studying communications, and she's just a power. She started her own company in comms, doing social media, which is what she started with us. So that's just one, and then I'll share one other one really quickly. So yesterday, there's a conversation happening in Aotearoa at the moment where the government has pushed back on pay equity for women, and it's just really heartbreaking, because it's impactful for wahine Māori, wahine Pasifika and whānau hauā, our disabled communities, as well as our rainbow communities and rangatahi. And that was only done 2 days ago, and I got really upset about it, and I was like, this is not good. Like, it impacts thousands and thousands and thousands of women. Over 150,000 women are directly impacted by this. And so I was like, right, I'm doing something about it. So then I just like reached out to women that I know. So we had Tara Singh join our call yesterday, who is the CE for UN Women Aotearoa. We had Delwyn Stewart join, who's the CE for YWCA. We had Amy McLean join, who's the CE for Kāinga Wahine. We had our network on it. We had the Māori lead for CCS Disability, who represents all of the Māori women throughout the country. We had Kieran Leone, who is an Auckland councillor running for mayor next year. We had Marama Davidson, co-leader of the Greens Party. So to be able to mobilise that level of support within kind of 12 hours for me is an indication of the power of the work that we do, but also the mana enhancing relationships that I have with women, where I can go, hey, this is not cool. Let's have a conversation to see how we can make, as a collective, we can leverage our networks, leverage our communities, so that we can advocate for the women who are not normally around these tables. So, you know, we had academics, we had Māori Women's Development Inc., Global Women, just this huge, you know, researchers like Dr. Leone Pihama saying, yep, I'm in, let me know what you need. Do you need us to write a submission? Shall we go down and see Christopher Luxon? So I'm really proud of the work that we're doing in that space to really stand for women's rights around pay equity, but other things, and that we can mobilise that type of support within 12 hours.
It's incredibly impressive, and I'm glad you touched on that because, yeah, I'm still reading New Zealand news over here, and I'm shocked at kind of what is actually going on politically at the moment. And in terms of some of the other things that I've noticed that kind of saddens me a lot is in terms of representation, particularly for Māori and local broadcasting as well, do you feel like there is a severe lack in funding, especially in public broadcasting, Māori television, Māori radio? Are you seeing like a big cultural shift that's actually going down rather than improving? Or are you seeing that there's now alternative modes that are happening? Because we talked about how podcasting is becoming a big thing. Influencers and Māori influencers are a rising thing. Are you saying that maybe the cultural shift is just it's going to new media rather than relying on the old dogs? Or do you think we are seeing a decline in Māori-led media in general?
Well, obviously, with the new government, the funding has been pulled from Māori television. I think they lost $12 million. It might actually even be more. So that's massive. That's a massive cut. All of the funding that was taken out of te reo Māori training and development, you know, to be able to feed the industry in terms of Māori broadcasting. And that has impacts across, you know, Te Irirangi or Aotearoa, the Māori radio network. Having that funding pulled has just been hugely damaging for Māori radio. I mean, I started them. You know, it's so funny because when I look around at all the top broadcasters, they all came out of Māori. They either all came out of Māori or they were an offshoot of Ruia Māori. So Ruia Māori was like our Māori equivalent, full te reo Māori equivalent. So you've got like Stacey, right? Robert, myself. Yep. So Robert, number one, I don't know where he is now, Breeze or something. Right, so still in there. And then you've got Stacey, who was breakfast host on Flavour. You know, you've got Scotty Morrison, who's one of the most recognised broadcasters in the country. He all came out of that. Him and I were night hosts together, so we're actually really good friends. He used to be the night host on Ruia Māori, and then I was the night host on MyFM. You know, Orini Kaipara, first woman with a moko kauai in mainstream. They all came out of that movement. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, there's, like, how do you even measure that level of success? How do you, you know, everyone in broadcasting, whether that's film, television, new media, you know, they've all come out of that. Like, they're all my peers, which is great because I can just ring them and go, okay, I need a story. Okay, one network news, Scotty, I need you to get me that. Or, okay, Stace, we need to cover this. Or, you know, Shannon, who is the Māori lead at RNZ. So you've got this very strong network of broadcasters who came up in the ranks together. And that was because of the investment that was made. It was a minimal investment, but it was very smart and very strategic. And now you have the fruits of that, where you have the top broadcasters that are, you know, Julian Wilcox, Stacey Daniels, myself, Scotty, Ordini, all of them came through that vianga, that standard. So it's really sad to see the decline in funding. Especially when you look at the return on investment for all of Aotearoa, not just Māori. Yeah.
100%. And I think in the same respect, something that I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day who asked me about representation for Māori people. This is an Argentine of all people was asking me, oh, it's so weird because I know a lot about Māori culture from watching film and television and everything else. Is it kind of weird that the culture is almost championed outside of New Zealand more than inside of New Zealand? Have you found that a lot when like talking to people from overseas? Because I think that is the thing I've always found. I've met plenty of travelers in my time here, people that have lived in different countries, and they always speak about how beautiful the culture is. Does it still bother you that it seems like the government doesn't understand the importance of that?
It's so crazy. Like, it is so crazy when tourism is one of the most, you know, it's one of the highest yielding things that we have in Aotearoa, right, is tourism and travel. And, you know, just like us, when we go overseas, when we go to Argentina, I want to see like Argentinian dancing, and I want to dine where the locals eat, and I want to see it, and I want to experience it. And when I go to Hawaii, what I want to do is I want to see hula dancing, and I want to go to halau, and I want to do that, right? It's crazy. I mean, it's been going for years and years and years. There's the, you know, ever since Moana and the Moa Hunters were traveling through Europe, and she is this exotic, beautiful, you know, stunning songstress, and then you come home and then people are, you know, I mean, perfect example, Hine Wehi Mohi has this number one hit in Aotearoa and globally, and then is booed for singing the national anthem in Te Reo. So it's always existed and it continues to exist. I think now with, like we were saying earlier, with the democratization of media and the influencer culture, it's just now too late. Like, you just, you know, like if you look here, the Morning Shift is the number one podcast in New Zealand. And they're, you know, they broke off and now they're doing their own. And it's awesome. Right. And Jordan was on, the Jordan River was like on my FM and left it to start his own. I'm like, bro, that's like gangster. Like, that yes. is so cool. That's like taking the original intent and then doing it in your own backyard. And if we, you know, if we just look at the rise in Waiata Māori, that is now, you know, there was no Māori songs that were played when we started. And now you hear every kind of hour, at least, you know, one all in Te Reo Māori, or, you know, a Māori artist or a Pacific artist, or, yeah, it's very cool. So it still happens, which is frustrating because the government doesn't get it and the decision makers don't get it and the people in charge of budgets, which are being announced shortly, don't get it. And if anything, they're taking away from an industry that has grown some of our greatest talent in front and behind the camera. Yeah.
I'll say, like, an example I can think of from my hometown alone is Marlon Williams, who lived about 5 minutes away from me through the Littleton Tunnel. Used to go see him at the local dairy to go buy stuff, you know? What a legend, you know? Full
oh my
album
gosh.
In Te Reo, like, beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah, what a legend.
My yeah. husband just went to his movie launch the other night and just was
oh, you're joking, the doco launch. Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
See, there you go. You know what?
It was just
bridges the oceans.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Loved it, and he'd been traveling around Europe, and, you know, absolutely, absolutely. It's such a precious commodity, but the government often misses it, doesn't see the value, doesn't recognise and understand the value of it, yeah.
In terms of other projects that you're running, one of the ones that I would say is that the major one you're running at the moment is Mana Wahine Aotearoa, which you have a pretty like massive support network, and this is all run off Facebook. I'd love to know a little bit more about the work that you guys are doing in the community and how that all meshes together with the existing work you're doing with your PR media company as well as the other courses that you're running.
Yeah, cool. Okay, very, very cool. So I'm really passionate about women's empowerment. I love it. I mean, I can't come from a tribe where, you know, it's named after a woman and not. Mana Wahine Aotearoa is a beautiful community. It started in COVID because Wahine Māori couldn't gather. And for Wahine, but also for Māori, it's important that we gather. So we were given seed funding and they said, replicate the great work you're doing with women on Facebook, on social media. And so we did that and we've grown it to, I think our Facebook group has around 22,500, and then our Facebook page has 2, and then our Instagram has, I don't know, 1,000, and then 2. Altogether, we've got almost 30,000 women in our community, which is awesome across all of our socials. And it really exists to empower, enable, and elevate women by any means necessary. So we do lots of different things. We are at the moment running a research project with Auckland Council, and they're really interested in what women think around housing, what they think around enterprise, what they think around health, so that that can feed into their strategic framework. And I think, you know, Jamie, what I'm most proud of is for us, what we want to do is we want to empower women's voices, what they think, what they feel, and their lived experience. And then we want to pay women, because historically that, you know, community contribution has never really been valued. You know what I mean? Like, you go in and you get invited and you get a cup of tea and it's gone. But we're like, no, that's that lived experience of someone from Moirua is as valuable as any consultant that you pay $300 to. And so we've done a lot of work to be able to get funding and get it into the hands and homes of the women that we partner with. So when we're doing kaupapa like the one we're doing now, we see it as a paid partnership. We don't see it like, oh, can you just come and we'll just take all your whakaaro and all your ideas and all your kōrero, and then we'll get paid lots of money by the researchers to do that and have it all locked up in the organization. So I'm really proud of the work that we do there. We do some incredible work with young people. But with women, it really is an opportunity for us to be seen, to be heard, to be validated, and to be in a safe community. So our Facebook group is closed. It's a private group, and you have to apply to get into it, which means that women can just be ourselves. Like, we can whinge, we can celebrate, we can laugh, we can create, we can, and it's a safe space for us. It's really beautiful. It's my passion project that's not funded to do that. We don't have any funding to do it. We've just grown it from scratch because it's something that is meaningful to us that, you know, Jamie, I think if we're blessed with a talent, it is our duty to use that talent to uplift others around us. And for me, one of the self-expressions is women.
And to rewind a little bit as well, you talked about equity in the respect to obviously salary, among other things. But what do you think are some of the biggest challenges for women at the moment in the professional space? Because I think a lot of people recognize that at the moment, we're still not seeing as many women in leadership roles as we should be seeing. What do you feel needs to change for that to move forward? Is it a case of culture? Is it a case of women having self-belief in what they're doing and knowing that they deserve to be in that professional space? Or is it a case of a combination of both?
I think a lot of it is systemic. I think a lot of it is systemic. Like, when you have a female prime minister, you're going to have a different view on the world. So whether that's Jacinda, and whatever we think about Jacinda is irrelevant. When you have women in positions of power, real power like that, like Helen Clark, like Jacinda Ardern, you know, women lead differently. We tend to lead more collaboratively. We tend to lead more collectively. We tend to lead from our heart. And sometimes in professional spaces, that's seen as a weakness. But in all of the experience I've had, is that's one of the things that makes women such effective ninjas at being catalysts for change, is that we have the ability to have great relationships, is that we see things further than a dollar value, that we it's much more holistic, I think. So I think just definitely it's systemic. Like, you know, if we look at what's happening with the government, they want to reverse all of the amazing work that's been done around diversity, equity, and inclusion. They're trying to define what a woman is, and then telling our rainbow takatāpui communities what that is and what identity is and whether that's valid or not. You know, if we look at the pay equity conversation that just happened 2 days ago, that's unwinding like 40. It's take like women all over the country. There's a massive protest today. I'm going to the protest today at 1 with my daughters. But the unions have activated protests right throughout the entire country today at 1. You know, and so it's systemic, a lot of it. And until we get women into positions of power, And when I say systemic, you know, once we get organizations having DEI policies where they have to do progressive procurement opportunities to give disadvantaged or marginalized communities opportunities to even just get on the playing field, then that's going to start to shift things. Once we get women in positions of power, that's going to start to shift things. Because the research says that every woman that's empowered goes on to empower 10 others, right? We go on. So the change we can have in positions of power. So if I can influence 22,000 women in whatever capacity, tiny, little, big, small, multiply that by 10, and suddenly we've got 220,000 women. I would then go out and I would empower girls, boys, men, right? So just 10 people. That's what the research says. Empower a woman, she goes on to empower 10 others. That alone is phenomenal. And, you know, you just need to look at it, like Barbie being the largest grossing movie throughout the world. You know, you look at Beyonce being the highest paid woman entertainer who owns her own brand. Then you look at Taylor Swift, who is ridiculous $1 billion for two, right? So there's this whole kind of shift that is happening. But then you've got, with the current administrations, and I won't say which ones, but if you know, you know, the current administrations just like putting a lid on that and saying, no, diversity is not to be valued. Everyone should be valued on their own merit. And yes, that's true. But if you're already disadvantaged, you're not even at an equal standing point. So it's critically important. And, you know, with the women that I know and can mobilize, it's really exciting. So, you know, Tara Singh, who we on our call was signing in from the east coast of New York yesterday, and I actually did a co-pupper with her at the UN a few years ago, was like, this is going to be the start of a conversation that could potentially be global for change, for women's rights and for change. So it's exciting.
Young people have always been at the forefront of a lot of social change, but do you feel a lot more young people now are mobilizing more than ever before, especially in New Zealand? Are you seeing that as another shift, that young people are far more like socially aware, socially impactful, have a lot more influence than probably people from our generation? Do you feel like that's happening now?
Definitely. And in Te Ao Māori, because these kids have been raised in kura kaupapa, it's completely different from how I was raised, right? So I was just, you know, went to a normal school, not normal, but just, you know, just went to everyday school or tedious school, intermediate, college. That's it. These kids have been raised in kōhanga reo, kura kaupapa, and have been taught. They are first language speakers. They are staunch. They are technologically savvy. They are, you know, technology natives. They have the knowledge, they have the audacity, which I got a sense of at my when I was growing up. I was lucky though, it was very rare. They have the audacity and they have the wherewithal to use the tools. And then when you get that, it's lethal. That's how you mobilize Toitū Te Tiriti and get 120,000 people marching on Parliament in 3 months with no funding. That's how you create groundswell movements led by young people, because that was led by, you know, the triplets and Maria Meno's sons and a handful of passionate rawhitiroa, a handful of passionate young Māori leaders who are unapologetic and unrestrained and are just like, no. Let me tell you what the new narrative is and let me show you that with people power. So it's very, very... it's very inspiring. It's very inspiring because, you know, power to the people. Power to the people is where it's at. Mm.
And you've gone from little North Island town to Auckland to being on the airwaves to running your own businesses to running these leadership courses. Vashane, what do you feel has been the constant thing in this whole journey for you? What do you feel has been the driving force for you throughout this whole time?
Good question. I think for me, faith is really important. So I was raised in a whānau where faith is valuable, and that's what that provides is that you, for me, what that's provided for me is a knowing that regardless of whatever's happening, it will be okay. Like it will be, I will be okay. And also that I have the ability. There's one of my whakatauki that I love in Te Ao Māori is hei kai kei aku ringa, which means there is food at my fingertips. So I had the ability to create food for myself and others. And integrity is really important to me. So and the work that we do is having integrity. Like I see lots of people who talk a good game, but they don't live it. And that's not about perfectionism, that's not about us being perfect and always having to get it right, but there is a level of, if we're going to stand on the pai pai, which is like speaking place in Māori, where you stand, and often where the leaders will, or lead orators can influence our people, then don't be standing up there and then go out the back for a spliff. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to do it, realize that leadership is sometimes lonely and it comes with responsibility. It do, you know, sure, anyone can turn on TikTok and become a TikTok guru, but is that how you're living? And are you giving back? And, you know, or is it just, yeah. So I'm quite staunch about that, is that our leadership should be lived and it should be practiced. Not to say that we always get it right, far from it. But there's a level of truth and integrity. And that really comes from my upbringing. That really comes from my upbringing is, you know, be puno, be shame, be authentic. If you haven't got it figured out, say it. It's okay. It's fine. And always be in service. And if I can do that, then I know I'm on the right track.
And for Shane, if anyone wants to kind of learn more about the great work that you're doing in the community, learn more about yourself, or maybe get you into another feature film, how can people get in contact with you and how can they learn more about the okay, great work Taika, that you're doing?
Right, Taika, yeah, if, yeah, come on. Chelsea, if you're watching for the next feature film or the next voiceover for Shrek. So they can hit us up at Manawahine Aotearoa. It's our Facebook group. You can hit us up there, or you can also just email me. I'm pretty open. So it's just vshane@madav.co.nz. We're on LinkedIn. You know, we're on Facebook. I'm not very good at Instagram. My kids are like, no, you're too old to be on Instagram, Mum. Haven't quite figured that one out. I'll get some sweet onto it, young person, to help us out there. But yeah, just reach out. We're really open to collaboration. We're open to social impact and change and really using the gifts. You know, just to, I guess, end, Jamie, like everything that I learned at MyFM is expressed in the work that I do now, whether it's cultural integrity, whether it's personal integrity, whether it's kaupapa driven, whether it's bringing the tribe along with us, whether it's leadership through service. A lot of it, if, you know, not all of it, because I was also raised really well, I want to say that, but, you know, those early formative years of my career were influential and absolutely a shout out, if I can say it, to Vivian Bridgewater, who is still a dear friend. I see her often, and she's still giving me advice about what I should be doing. And darling, it's all about story, and you need to, you know, craft it, darling. Is that what she says? Tauta Irueda. And, you know, we're actually just talking about now making a documentary, actually, Jamie. So making a documentary 30 years on, where are we now? What's it, what is it, you know, plant, what were the seeds that were planted that have flourished? So watch this space.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.